This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello, dear listener, and welcome back to Owning It, the Anxiety Podcast with me, Caroline Foran. Don't forget to sign up to Owning It Real Time. I am loving the reviews that are coming in so far, and I'm so thrilled to have had a clinical psychologist himself tell me that this is exactly the kind of thing that he would use in clinic with his own patients when especially trying to help them with anxiety in the middle of the night. So if you're having trouble sleeping, do go check out Owning It Real Time and you'll have gorgeous, sweet dreams. You can access Owning It Real Time at the link in the podcast notes or at the link in my bio on my Instagram page at Owning a Podcast or at Caroline Foran. Now, this week my guest is Rosanna Davison. She is stunning inside and out. She's a former Miss World. She's a mother of three. She's a nutritionist. She's a best-selling author. And most of all, she is such an incredible spokesperson for fertility issues in Ireland and abroad as well. She has had an incredibly difficult journey to get to becoming a mother. She is one now. She's a mother to three, and here she shares her story with me about anxiety and fertility, the entire journey, the anxiety that goes with all of the losses, all of the wondering, the waiting, the not knowing what will happen, the not knowing what her future will look like. There is a lot to discuss here, and I'm so grateful to Rosanna for sharing with me and being so vulnerable. And I really hope that if you are on your own fertility journey and you're feeling very anxious, that you feel less alone for this conversation and find some comfort in it. Thank you so much for tuning in. Rosanna Davison, I've wanted to talk to you for so long on this podcast because I've had so many requests from people to talk about the relationship between fertility and anxiety and the long journey that people can go on and the work that goes with it and the wondering if it will ever happen. And then the becoming a parent also brings its own anxieties too. So I'm so excited to chat to you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Caroline. I know it's been a long time coming. I'm so grateful to be a guest on your podcast, knowing how popular it is as well. It's such an important topic to look at, or a series of topics. And I know we chatted about potentially talking on the podcast, I think it was last June in the toilets at the VIP Awards. Delighted we've managed to get it together. And go us. I mean, we've got families and commitments and busy lives. So I'm delighted to sit down.
For anyone who is listening and isn't familiar with you, I can't imagine that such a person exists, but you are a mother of three. At one point, you had three under one.
Yes, my twins were born 3 days before our daughter Sophia turned one. That was towards the end of 2020. I was in hospital, and it's sort of a joke, but it sort of isn't. But that was the last time I actually lay down and had a bit of a rest, was after my C-section, after having the twins. They were in the NICU at the time. So there's 3 days under a year between all three of them.
Wow. And you're super busy with work. You're a best-selling author. You're a qualified nutritionist. You're a model. You were Miss World. You have your hands full and you do it all and you make it look effortless. But I know there's a lot of work and organization goes into it. Today, obviously, we're going to talk about anxiety and your fertility journey. But before we get into that, I mean, you had a whole life before that journey ever began. You were in the public eye. You have a fairly well-known father. Would you say anxiety was a feature of your life growing up as a teenager or as a 20-something year old?
You know, you say I had a life before having a family. I can barely, and maybe you're the same, but I can barely think back to the person I used to be before I became a mom, and my whole perspective changed and whole, thought process changed every day. And it's hard to even imagine what I used to do with my time, but I know I had fun. Growing up, I was definitely a worrier, and that was the word used actually to my mum by my teacher. I remember being in fourth or fifth class in primary school, and I do remember it was the day we were doing a modern dance routine, and I couldn't get it right. I've never been the best dancer. I love to dance at a wedding, say, but I'm pretty brutal. And I remember getting really frustrated and worrying and trying to get it perfect and worrying that it wasn't. And later that day, my teacher said, just keep an eye on Rosanna. She's definitely prone to being a worrier and a little bit of a perfectionist. And, she's young. She can just, maybe relax a little bit more and not take things so seriously. So I do, thinking back, I was always prone to perfectionist tendencies and just trying to make sure everything was right and wanting to be good at everything I tried. And it wasn't because I was comparing myself to my classmates or trying to be better than anyone else. It was just trying to maybe live up to my own expectations of myself. And I feel that that has continued somewhat into adult life, where I have expectations of how I want to behave or how I want to complete a task or the timelines that I want to get things done or goals for the year. And I would put myself under an awful lot of pressure to get things done and what I see is the right way. And it's, again, as I said, it's not competing with anyone else. It's just competing with myself. And I'm getting better. I am working on it. It's an ongoing work in progress. But it's certainly been a feature of my personality throughout my life.
It sounds like you feel more zen when you feel like under, I think most people do when they feel under control of everything. Yeah. And like with a lot of spinning plates, it is in a weird way, like being in control solves any anxiety, but it also creates it because at some point, all the spinning plates, like one of them will probably drop.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You need to be okay with that, but that's really hard. That's really hard. And you obviously had like such a massive career in the public eye. I know it was, you told me it was 20 years ago that you were crowned Miss World. I feel like, were you 5 years old? Like you could not be old enough for that to have happened 20 years ago. But that was before, obviously, the world we live in now with social media and stuff. Was that an anxious time? Being in such a appearance focused, well, from the outside, it seems to be an appearance focused environment, and where you could easily, if have perfectionist tendencies, you could easily start to like link your self-worth or your value to how you look. And especially if you're in those kind of competitions and pageants where it's actually being measured, like it's actually a metric for your success in that field. How do you get through that without, I guess, a lot of anxiety?
Do you know what? I was lucky in many ways going into Miss World, because I was very much a normal first year university student in UCD. And I found myself in Miss Ireland and then going to Miss World. And it was never, I never saw myself as a glamorous girl. Growing up, I was a tomboy. I had horses. I was happiest mucking about in the fields and muddy wellies. And I was always just outdoors, really into sports, athletics, horse riding. And so I never saw myself as that kind of glamorous girl. I was never allowed to wear makeup growing up. I think all, probably a lot of us had access to back then was, a little bit of Rimmel in the pharmacy. So I was never interested really in that side, and I never identified with it. It was never my big goal to be a beauty queen. It very much, obviously, I'm hugely grateful it happened and it did change my life in a very positive way. But it sort of just happened by chance. And I just found myself on this train to Miss World, and I just went with it. And I found when When I went to China in December 2003 for Miss World, I mean, I'd had a lot of help and support from people like Lisa Fitzpatrick, helped me to pack. She put together, she was incredible. She put together and two outfits or three outfits, I think it was, per day for a month and helped me pack them. And she listed them out. She accessorized them, you know, daytime outfits, suits for kind of press conferences and media work, evening gala outfits. I didn't really have a clue. I mean, I was used to being in jeans, jodhpurs, tracksuits, that kind of thing. It was back when O'Neill's were the cool yeah. thing to wear around campus. So, you know, I was going into this new world. And because of that, I had low expectations of myself in that environment. I was going in, it being totally new to me, not knowing what to expect. I very much was of the attitude that I was going into a very new experience. I'd probably make some friends, enjoy the travel aspect, probably wouldn't be placed. You know, it wasn't like I was going in fully prepared, fully imagining myself as this world-class beauty queen, because that wasn't the case at all. But what I did find was that my sort of tendency towards perfectionism and my tendency to be anxious actually worked in my favor over there. Because I remember it was about halfway through the first week there. So we spent a month traveling around China, starting in Hong Kong, and we went to Shanghai, Beijing, Xi'an, all sorts of places. And it was incredible. But I remember about halfway through that first week, looking around at the girls and thinking, wow, they're really prepped. I mean, one of the girls had a handbook she used to consult in different situations. You know, I would see them maybe elbow a few others to the side to get to the front of a photograph. I saw others, you know, I'm not being bitchy. It wasn't a bitchy environment at all, but it was just competitive in a healthy way because, you know, the girls were there to compete and I wasn't being competitive at the beginning. So I would see another, maybe if we were, say, visiting a hospital or an orphanage, you know, I'd see another maybe pick up the nearest baby and hold it for the photo. You know, I just started noticing how the girls were being a little bit more competitive. So I started copying them and doing the same. And I just found then throughout the next few weeks, just becoming really super competitive, perfectionist. I, you know, would make sure I had three different outfit changes every day so that you were never photographed in the same outfit. And it just became quite strategic, I suppose is the word. So it did work in my favor. And then by the end of the fourth week, when it came to the competition, I felt like I was fully sort of prepped and trained and polished in this whole world of being a beauty queen. So that probably worked in my favor. But maybe just going in really fresh, really new, really amateur to the whole thing actually was beneficial. Yeah, because it just opened my eyes to what the others were doing and how they were viewing the whole thing. So yeah, as I said, that will be 20 years ago this December.
You got used to, I mean, having to always be photo ready. And I think that's changed so much now, where we're so much more willing to be raw and vulnerable. And like the way, so like, thankfully the way social media is going is like, we can no longer keep up with the constant need to put out a version of ourselves that is so curated or, sanitized even. But back then it was very much like you said, don't be seen in the same outfit twice. And like, it's such a world away from now, where we're like
mad, yeah,
going out of our way to be like, look how I'm wearing the same dress three times. Has that carried over, that need to be photo ready, that kind of training in being, you know, face front first always? Do you feel you wouldn't be able to not be photo ready in like on social media or going down to the shop? Would that unnerve you?
No, well, sorry, first of all, just to comment on what you were saying previously, yeah, it does feel like an absolute world away where you know, at Miss World, I mean, Miss World isn't real life either. You know, I remember having massive anxiety there. I remember having a stress headache for days actually, because I'd be in the shower and we were told we had 10 minutes to be ready for a photo shoot or for filming. So the first time that happened, I just thought, oh God, I can never leave myself in a situation where I have wet hair and I'm not ready to be photographed.
I have wet hair
again.
Right now.
I'm only glammed up because I have to work straight after this. But it did teach me quite quickly that you know, it would be beneficial maybe to be ready to go all the time. And then throughout my Erasmus world, because I took a year out of college, I would maybe have to take a transatlantic flight, get off, say, in Toronto, for example, get ready on the plane for a red carpet kind of gala dinner and go straight to that. So I got quite efficient at getting myself ready in tiny spaces like toilets on planes and putting on a ball gown. So the anxiety of not being photo ready has kind of made me more aware of being polished just day to day. But saying that, just to answer your question there, no, it doesn't unnerve me to be, and I do put up snaps of me with the kids first thing in the morning and that kind of thing on social media. But on the flip side, I am also aware that what you put on the internet is there forever potentially. So, you know, if it is a photo that you don't love, or if it's maybe a photo or a video or a piece of content that can be taken out of context and used in a different way, then I'm always conscious of that. And again, that's maybe just part of the awareness I've had over the past 20 years of the media and how things can be taken out of context and every comment you make can be picked up in a particular way. So it's a bit of everything really, you know, that comes together and sort of makes me the way I am now.
Knowing the perils of social media now, I mean, I know there's lots of benefits. Would you go through the same thing now if in the world of social media that you did 20 years ago?
I would, based on, you know, if I was the same age, if I was 19, going into Miss World again, you know, now, I would go into it, but I would probably be armed with much more awareness, or I'd try and get as much advice as possible about social media and about just being online and being vulnerable and putting yourself out there. Because, you know, I do think maybe it is taught in schools, but I do think that at primary level need to be taught about social media and bullying online and just, you know, learning about how things can be taken out of context and used against you. And just what you were saying there previously about showing the glammed up versions of you. I always, you know, when I see maybe another mother looking glam online, I first think, good for you. It's actually really hard to get to that point where your hair and makeup is done. But also I, you know, think, you know, I look at myself and think, well, most, 99% of my day is spent in my leggings and hoodie combo. You know, I rotate them, I think, most days, you know, with hair up, probably, you know, makeup on, pseudocreme on a spot, you know, looking really every day. So when you do get dressed up, you think, wow, I feel great. I want to, you know, show how great I feel. So I always think, you know, I never look at people and think, oh, you must look like that all the time. Oh, you put so much work into it. No, I think obviously you've just got dressed up and you feel great and you feel confident. And, you know, there were days, particularly when my children were newborns, where you'd just be going for days with like leaky boobs and, you know, feeling crap about yourself and just feeling worn out. And then when you did get a little bit glammed up, you'd think, gosh, I feel great. I feel like myself again. And, you know, you'd want to show that side of you. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it really is. It's such a underrated tool for confidence and a feeling of power and pep in your step. I mean, that's why we've always used it.
And then there's the sort of more normal, I wouldn't say boring, life isn't that boring with small children, but just the normal everyday stuff. I mean, I could put up all of that, but it's not that interesting, really. It's just stuff that we're all doing.
Yeah,
you know, I must hoover the kitchen 6 times a day. I must clean, you know, food off cushions more probably than that. It's not that interesting. It's just, and I do show a lot of behind the scenes stuff as well, like the chaos and the mess the twins make. And the fact that I do have to trail around them cleaning up, or else just by the end of the day, like, it looks like the house has been burgled. But that stuff isn't, like, that's a lot of people's everyday reality. You don't necessarily want to just show them what they're doing anyway themselves. You want to show something a bit different, or let it be of value to people. I think particularly since COVID, and you mentioned earlier about social media being more authentic and people responding more to authenticity, I really think, yeah, since COVID, since lockdown, social media has been really strongly going towards, you know, showing our authentic selves, maybe discussing our feelings and emotions and realities and challenges so much more, and just showing, you know, snapshots of kind of everyday life and normal things, but also making it of value to people. You know, I always think before I post something, you know, will anyone get any value out of this? Will it give them some kind of information, or, you know, raise some kind of emotion in them? You know, I always think like that now. I think lots of other people do as well. You just want to be putting out information that's of value or of help to others or support. Or
you've been a massive support for people with their fertility journey. I mean, we're mentioning here, you know, your three toddlers, but there was a time when you were told you might never have a baby. So let's get on to that. I mean, to fast forward from Miss World, you meet Wes, you fall in love, you're together, you get married. Did you say you decided to have a year of just enjoying marriage and then assumed you would just try for baby and it would just happen?
Yeah, so we got married when we were 30. We said we'd just enjoy a year of travel and married life, and then we'd try for family. We both knew we wanted families. So when we did start trying early 2016, it happened straight away. You know, went to my GP, got that confirmed. I had my 8-week scan booked in hospital, told my family at about 5.5 weeks. And at the time, I was about 31, and I just thought, what could possibly go wrong? You know, we're both young, fit, healthy, got pregnant straight away. Obviously, it was easy for us, thank goodness. You know, I felt very, very lucky. I remember when I told my family, my mom just took me aside and just said, be careful, it's early, anything can go wrong. And I just thought, you know, it was mom being worried. She'd had her fair share of fertility issues as well. But at the time, miscarriage and infertility weren't on my radar. I just felt it had never been covered in school. Friends hadn't spoken about it. I knew of a couple of friends who did have miscarriages around the 6 to 7 week mark, but had gone on to have full term healthy pregnancies after that. So I just thought, if it does happen, it's probably, you know, a genetic anomaly and you will go on and have a healthy baby. So I had my first miscarriage, unfortunately, started bleeding at about 6.5 weeks with that first pregnancy. Had first very painful, very traumatic miscarriage. And, you know, I think I'm still working through the trauma of pregnancy loss now. And it's such a complex trauma that every time I talk about it, you sort of unearth different emotions and different memories. You know, so after that first miscarriage, I was advised just to wait a month, try again. Tried again, the same thing happened. I lost the pregnancy at around the 6.5 week mark. Tried again, same thing happened for a third time. So after the third loss, I remember feeling a little bit more sort of strong, maybe. I just felt, okay, it's happened three times. I can do this. I feel like I didn't feel sort of weakened, or I didn't feel like quitting or anything.
Is it like what people fear the most? You had been there three times, so what else was there to fear?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, the first loss shook me to the core. I mean, the feeling of the hormones almost draining from your system, and that really primal feeling of being pregnant just sort of taken away overnight. And it was painful and messy, and it was horrible. The next two weren't as painful, and they were more sort of more smooth, I suppose is the easiest way to say it, but still very upsetting. I mean, once, no matter what stage of a pregnancy you lose it, you know, you've taken that test, you imagine your due date, you imagine how life will change in 9 months time, you know, you get that spark of excitement. No matter what, it's very hard to say to yourself, well, it might not happen, don't get excited. And particularly at the beginning of a journey.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
At what stage, I mean, I know you went on to have so many more than you should ever have to experience. Oh my God.
But at what stage? I was 14 of those, yeah, in total.
At what stage or where in that line of 14 do you start to feel the anxiety of, okay, this might not just be a one-off fluke or random event. Now I don't know what my future that I had sort of envisioned. I don't know what that will look like. When did that set in and how were you feeling mentally?
After about a year and a half of, you know, losses almost every cycle I was getting pregnant but losing it, but every time I'd have a loss I'd go to, and I saw about five different consultants in total in five different clinics, we'd go into a different area of testing or try a different type of medication. So I sort of found that each time I got pregnant I'd say, right, I'll do something a little bit differently, or we took a different approach or took different blood tests. So that kind of kept me going for a while. But I remember specifically it was April 2017. I just had a hysteroscopy where they looked into my uterus to look for structural irregularities, and the surgeon cut out a little sort of piece of tissue, which I was told may have been obstructing the, you know, proper implantation, and that may have been the cause of my issues. So I remember after that being told, wait a couple of months before you try again, which we did. And I was convinced that that was the root of, the name for the tissue was called a septum there. I couldn't remember. And so I remember thinking that was, and as well, my consultant being quite positive that that was the root of my issues. And it was just poor implantation into this fibrous tissue that wasn't as sort of spongy as your uterus lining.
While you're on that point, I mean, I know with a lot of my friends who've gone through fertility issues, it seems with them like such a huge part of the anxiety is like when it's undiagnosed and you don't have anything tangible to say this is why. So did you feel like you could kind of latch on to that information and say, okay, I can, again, going back to the control and the being able to say, this makes sense now, I can address this?
Yeah. So up until that point, there had been a lot of self-blame, a lot of confusion, I spent hours researching as well myself just to try and figure out what could be happening, because no tests. I mean, I probably had hundreds of tests done and scans. Nothing was showing up anything significant enough to be causing every pregnancy to fail at 6.5 weeks. Nobody could figure it out. You know, one of the consultants I saw said to me he'd been in fertility practice for 25 years and he'd never seen the likes of it, where somebody could get pregnant so easily but lose it so quickly as well. So it was incredibly frustrating. And so after I'd had this procedure, I was really positive, excited, got pregnant again when we tried in the June. And again, the same thing happened, 6.5 weeks, started bleeding. And I remember just hitting the lowest point of the whole journey that day, really. And, I said to Wes, actually, I'd been thinking about it for maybe a week or so, but I remember having the conversation with him that I didn't think I was going to be the person to give him a family, and that maybe he'd be better off, you know, finding a partner who he could have children with, because I knew how badly he wanted to be a dad. And, you know, to me, it just made sense. You know, if you love him, let him go. Like, don't drag him through all of your problems. Because at this stage, you know, obviously fertility being a 50-50 issue, we'd long established that it was actually my issue. He was fine. And he had done all the tests as well for his sperm. So I remember him sort of smiling and just saying, no, you're the person I married. You're the person I want to have a family with. So, of course, I'm not going to leave you to find someone else. But it just made total sense. And it just showed how dark a place I got to, where it just made sense to me to try and break up with my husband. Anyway, after that, we started looking into reproductive immunology. And then, yeah, discovered that there was a little imbalance in my, well, significant imbalance in my immune system. So went on to medication to suppress my immune system. And that in itself is difficult. High dose prednisolone steroids, which have their side effects as well. I was on immune suppressants, all sorts of, you know, heparin, blood thinning medication. I was on progesterone injections. These things were making somewhat of a difference, according to my test results, but not significant enough, my consultant felt, to support a pregnancy. So, yeah, I got to the point then, maybe at the end of the year, where I was having side effects to the medication, like, well, obviously the bloating and the swelling that comes from steroids.
Just feeling like that physically poorly from all those injections.
Just feeling just depleted and worn out, and also depleted from the constant roller coaster of pregnancy hormones. So we got to the point then where I just went back to one of my initial consultants and just said, you know, I've tried absolutely everything. I've tried every test, scan, you know, been under, been on the operating table under anesthetic, nothing has worked. What will I do? And he just said, you know, I don't know if you're actually going to be able to, or I don't think you're going to be able to carry your own baby. You've done everything. Maybe look at other options. Surrogacy, he mentioned, could be an option, because our, you know, age was on our side. Fertility, by all means, we were fertile. You know, my AMH levels were very good. Obviously, you can't tell egg quality from any tests, but everything else pointed to our fertility itself being good. IVF wasn't an option, because getting pregnant was the simple bit. So I remember feeling horrified at the idea of surrogacy. I mean, anxiety levels hit the roof, as if they hadn't been bad enough already.
And what was the anxiety about with that? Was it not being able to be in control of it yourself?
Yes. So anxiety was high anyway, at that stage, because it was the fear of the unknown with infertility. You don't know if you'll actually get your happy ending or your healthy baby at the end of it. It was the anxiety of feeling like we'd come to the end of our options at that point. And I remember just doing what I always do when I'm feeling anxious, is making myself really busy with work. I signed up for a master's at the end of 2017, full-time master's. I just was trying everything to take my mind off the reality of our situation. But looking back, it's only, you realize looking back that, you know, you're behaving the way you did for a certain reason. And mine was to deal with my anxiety. The anxiety around surrogacy is a particular type of, yeah, lack of control. And the idea of, it was really the idea of a stranger carrying my baby, my pregnancy in a different country, thousands of miles away, that horrified me, to be honest. I just thought, how could I cope with seeing another woman carrying my child, carrying the pregnancy that I should be carrying? Then I started, you know, your mind goes to all sorts of dark places. And I started thinking, you know, would a potential surrogate, you know, grow attached to a baby? You know, what would her family think? You know, would she enjoy feeling the kicks and the movements? Just, your mind goes to a weird place.
I mean, was it impossible to sleep at night when you actually were on that journey and you knew it was happening and you knew the baby was coming and you knew the woman was carrying the baby?
Well, do you know what? I focused, and this is advice I'd give to anyone going through fertility, you know, fertility treatment or surrogacy, is just focus day by day on every tiny win, every tiny victory. And not looking at the bigger picture for too long. So, you know, every little victory for me was, say, going over to Kyiv, doing my egg retrieval operation. Okay, that was a big step out of the way. Next victory was the frozen embryo transfer into the surrogate. We weren't there for that. Now, that just happened when we got home. the next thing was the 2 week wait and then getting the pregnancy, a positive pregnancy test that our surrogate was pregnant. You know, I just lived scan by scan and tried not to think of the end, tried not to think of anything else but the medical information I was getting with each scan. So we chose commercial surrogacy. Yeah, it was just managing my anxiety all the way through, very actively, very, you know, I was very present in managing my anxiety throughout 2019 because it was the only way I could get through it. So, you know, we were getting at the beginning for the first trimester, we were getting every scan every fortnight. And I would be fine for the first week after the scan because I think, okay, everything's fine, normal growth, normal development. But then I just become a ball of anxiety for the second week, thinking, what if something's gone wrong? Every time my phone pinged for an email or a call came in, I'd jump because I'd think, oh no, she's lost the pregnancy. Oh no, there's been a miscarriage. Because you've become so programmed to expect the worst. You know, once you've had even one pregnancy loss, I think it takes the innocence and the magic out of pregnancy because you're aware of everything that can go wrong. So anyway, as you know, everything continued to go right throughout the surrogacy pregnancy with Sophia. But I found it very stressful. I mean, I couldn't stop thinking, what's she up to now? You know, what's she doing every day? What's she eating? Even though I knew that the clinic and the medical side of the clinic was looking after her carefully and monitoring her. But there came a point when she was 23 weeks pregnant, and I remember it so well. It was early August 2019, and I just couldn't help myself. I'd been Googling pictures of a 23-week bump just to see, you know, what she's showing and how big the bump might be. And I asked for a picture. And up until this point, we hadn't met her. We hadn't seen pictures of her. I didn't know who she was. I was only interested in the medical side. It was the only way I could cope with the whole thing. And I asked for a picture. So she very kindly obliged and sent me over a picture. And it was so sweet. She was in her apartment against pink wallpaper because at this stage we knew we were having a girl. She had painted her nails pink. She was wearing like a pink gym top and shorts with her bump in full view, like cradling her bump. And I remember just being so overwhelmed with obviously with gratitude and love and admiration for our surrogate, but also for like just devastation for myself that she was carrying my pregnancy, that she was, you know, feeling the kicks and the bump. And I was just desperate to have a bump of my own. So I remember it just brought all the human side to the fore for me, and I just found it very difficult. I couldn't look at those photos then after that because it brought the human element, the fact that there was a woman, you know. I knew there was a woman behind the pregnancy, but I was just trying not to imagine that, you know, this perfect creature could grow in her and not me, you know.
That alone is carrying so much. There's so many layers to what you are carrying. And then obviously, I mean, you get your happy ending. Sophia is born. But at that point, like, you've kind of swapped the anxieties of loss after loss and not really having the time or the space to process that because you're just always on to the next one because it's in flux. It's not something that ends.
And the total lack of control over my body and of the situation.
And then straight into the surrogacy journey, which is a whole other ball game of, like you say, all those variables of wondering. And then you're handed a newborn. Where at all, if at all, do you ever get to, or have you yet been able to process all that you carried up to that point?
Do you know what? I think through writing my book, through doing talks and podcasts, talking about it online, I think it's been my way of working through it and my sort of healing process. And it's been very cathartic to share my experiences and journey and anxieties and worries with others, and to realize that there are so many others out there who are dealing with infertility or pregnancy loss or, you know, any number of issues on their journey to become a parent. And I think there's so much power and so much healing in sharing our stories to be able to support others. And, you know, as I said earlier, when we started out on this journey, I had no idea about miscarriage. It wasn't anywhere in my conscience, really. And, you know, I think we've come a long way here in Ireland with the conversation, and maybe globally in the conversation around fertility. and pregnancy loss, because I feel like we're so much more able to talk about it, to share our experiences openly, to not feel the shame maybe that we used to. I remember feeling huge shame about my body because it wouldn't perform what it was designed to do. Not that my whole identity was wrapped up in being a mother or being able to give birth, not at all, but I sort of felt like I was born with the biological equipment to procreate, and why couldn't I? I must be dysfunctional in some way. So it's just by talking that we can really heal and process our trauma.
It's so important, like that element of self-blame, I think, when it comes to supporting other people who are like friends or family who are going through fertility issues. Because like you say, like until you're in it, experiencing it, you don't understand the ins and outs of it. You certainly don't understand the emotional effect if you haven't gone through it. I would love to ask you, what do you think isn't helpful, or what shouldn't we say to someone going through fertility issues?
Well, it's the usual comments like, maybe if you just relax, it'll happen for you, or why don't you try IVF, or, you know, why haven't you had a baby? And I used to get this when we got married. Maybe a year or two after we got married, people were sort of looking at my belly going, oh, is she, isn't she? And I remember being at a family event and an older lady saying to me, you know, you really should start having babies. How old are you? And I said, oh, I'm 32. And I had just had, I think, my second miscarriage. I'd had a couple anyway by this stage. I remember just being broken inside. And she was saying to me, you really should have a baby. I was 22 when I had my first. And me trying to think, what will I say? And I made up some excuse that I was too busy with work and I wasn't ready. But, you know, a couple of years later, I would have actually been completely honest with her and said to her, I'm struggling. I need help. I can't have a baby. But it takes a while maybe to come to terms with it yourself. And I did eventually make peace with the idea that I was the girl who couldn't have a baby naturally and that I needed medical support and the surrogate. But it did take a while to process that and come to terms with it. And funnily enough, when I went on to get pregnant with Hugo and Oscar, my twins, when it became apparent, say after the 20-week scan, that I was going to have two healthy full-term babies, I had to go and sort of reverse back through everything I'd come to terms with about myself. So it was like a reversal of everything I knew about myself, having established in my head that, you know, I was very lucky and fortunate in so many aspects of my life, but this was just one area where I couldn't, you know, where I needed help. I couldn't have a child. I had to sort of come to terms with the idea that I was pregnant with two healthy babies. And it was a really strange time, actually. Obviously, I was excited and delighted and elated and grateful and all those emotions, but there was a huge sense of guilt, like a survivor's guilt, that I had come out publicly only a few months previously on national television on the Late Late Show to say that I'd been through surrogacy, I couldn't have a baby myself, and, you know, I'd been sort of a public person, happy to talk about fertility, and now I was pregnant. And you know, I felt a huge sense of guilt for all the people who were really trying as well and who weren't having success. So it was another source of unexpected anxiety to be pregnant and, you know, to have two healthy babies growing inside of me. It's kind of hard to describe, but it took me a long time to announce it because of that.
I can imagine that, because you become this synonymous with infertility, and then it's like, oh, sorry, I'm actually not one of you guys anymore.
Yeah,
you know, it's happened. I mean, it's such a huge like, on top of everything you're dealing with, it's such a huge responsibility to be responsible for everybody else's fertility as well. Mm. You know, I mean, you were dealing
with... I do tend to feel like I'm responsible for other people's emotions or feelings, and I always have been like that. So it's,
yeah, and it's like, it's an amazing quality, but it can really wear you down, I think. Were you able, apart from the anxiety of the survivor's guilt, I suppose, after having gone through so many miscarriages, were you just holding yourself so tightly through that pregnancy? Was there any point where you relaxed and said, okay, it's actually happening now, I can breathe?
Well, certainly for the first trimester, or even 15, 16 weeks, I was pretty anxious. I was very nauseous up until about the end of week 13, start of week 14. But I think what was a really positive side of the whole experience of that pregnancy was that I was really well cared for in the hospital and by a specific twin team, because being identical twins, there are various issues. It was called a high risk pregnancy from the beginning, despite nothing going wrong. But I was very well monitored. So I was in for once a week scans at the beginning, and then later on every fortnight. So I think that gave me a lot of comfort knowing I was in great hands. But also once you begin to feel kicks and movements, that was very reassuring. And that's what marked it so differently to our surrogate pregnancy, because I had no control over any aspect of that. I couldn't feel obviously the kicks or anything. All I was doing was getting updated on the scans every couple of weeks. So at least I was so much in control of what I was eating, you know, what I was doing, where I was going, what activities I was doing. But yeah, saying that, I was anxious at the very beginning. The twins were conceived straight after my 15th miscarriage, which happened in early March 2020. That was a bizarre experience because I didn't know I was pregnant. Although I think once you've been through a fertility battle, you stop trying. I mean, we weren't trying to have a baby, but Sophia had just been born, but you don't try to prevent it either. Yeah, let's just say that. I had this anxiety, a whole separate anxiety about missing an egg every month. So I'd had this miscarriage at almost 11 weeks, which totally took me by surprise. But the twins were conceived a few weeks later. I had been warned actually that I'd be extra fertile after a miscarriage at that stage when I went into the hospital, and just, you know, to be a little bit careful. I didn't want another pregnancy so soon, but no, we decided not to be careful. Anyway, so that was a source of anxiety at the beginning of my twin pregnancy. And I did have quite a significant bleed at nearly 11 weeks with the twins, almost exactly the same time I'd had the previous miscarriage. And that gave me a huge fright. Luckily, you know, I went as quickly as possible the next morning into A&E at Holles Street, and they scanned me and everything was fine. But you know, I did have that little fright. But apart from that, it was a very smooth pregnancy, as far as a twin pregnancy can go. But you know, we were in lockdown, so I really just looked after myself and rested and ate really well, and you know, enjoyed the cravings, but any cravings I had, I indulged them. You know, poor Wes, my husband, was out nearly every evening to the shops to buy whatever it was I wanted. But yeah, I remember having noodles on toast one day and just all the carbs.
Oh, lovely. I mean, I want to ask you as well. So I didn't experience any fertility issues, and I got pregnant really quickly and it all went really well. Like it was very straightforward. What I wasn't prepared for was the anxiety that would come when I became a parent. I just thought giving birth was the finish line. This is a whole different conversation, but I mean, there is a lot of anxiety with that huge monumental shift of becoming a mother, becoming a parent, life looking so different to what it used to look like, not knowing what that sleep deprivation is like until you're in it, not knowing how it can mess with your head. But you've gone through this massive journey and now you're here with three babies. And that in itself is really hard on your relationship, really hard on, you know, obviously you have to put work on hold and everything. Did you feel like, because you'd been through so much and you'd fought so hard to get there, that you, no matter how many sleepless nights or how hard it was, or when you felt like, oh my God, I just need a break, or they're driving me crazy because they do, that you felt like you couldn't ever complain about it? Because, and for me, like if I wasn't able to say I'm finding it really hard, I would have exploded with the anxiety and stress, because that was like a release for me to say, is it just me? Is it okay if I say I don't love every second of this all of the time?
Yeah, you know, you're right. It can be really, really challenging some days. And even every day, there are different challenging moments. And some days you find yourself just counting the minutes until bedtime. But yeah, you're right. There's a certain element of me feeling guilty for complaining about them or complaining about my situation. You know, we are in a situation that it's very difficult to travel. I used to travel all the time for work and I miss it. I really do. It's been about 4 years, I think, since we've been away or even had a night away together, me and Wes. But it is what it is. We're just in a situation where, you know, the twins, Sophia's great now, she's three, but the twins are just at their wild destructive stage. And we just fear they'd trash a hotel room or anything if we brought them anywhere. But there is, yeah, there is a certain level of anxiety wrapped up in motherhood. And as you say, an anxiety and being completely honest about the difficult days and the sleep deprivation. And, you know, I do find it's sort of it's a real learning journey with them. And the thing about babies and toddlers is I think once you think you've mastered a certain phase, whether it's the weaning or the teething or, you know, the sleep, they suddenly change and move on to a new phase. And you find yourself going, oh my goodness, I wasn't prepared for this. And I was only saying this to Wes yesterday that Sophia used to be a bit of a handful, but now she's great. She's really calmed down. She started preschool just in the autumn. And she's just really sort of calm and sensible now. Whereas the boys have got to the point where they used to be a doddle, but now they're, you know, a handful. Like, you really have to keep an eye on them. They're hitting each other. They're, you know, being destructive. They're breaking things. So this is a new phase that they're going through that I actually wasn't prepared for. And I'm finding my responses can be quite knee jerk. And it's a whole sort of process of learning to respond to them, learning the best ways to be more patient. The best ways as well to look after yourself, I think, as a mother and as a father, obviously, as well. But, you know, I'm learning new coping strategies all the time. And, you know, it could be as simple as taking an hour to an hour and a half when they go to bed to just sit there and unwind. And just most nights I like to just sit in silence. I won't turn on the TV. I might listen to a podcast or read a book. But just no one to touch me, no one to ask me for anything. We have a very demanding small dog. He's quite old and he's a little bit incontinent, so he always needs to go out to pee. And he seems to find, you know, he seems to think that the minute the kids are in bed, it's his time to be demanding. It's his time to like want to sit on my knee or demand treats. And even when the dog starts to like nag me for things, I'm like, please just don't. Please just everyone leave me alone. And I think Wes is the same because he goes into his man cave / office and sits there as well. So it's not great for a relationship, really. But then maybe after an hour we both emerge from our caves and want to watch something on Netflix. But you do really need to build in that time every day to just be with yourself, to just process. I do meditate on and off. I find that helpful. I've various strategies for stress management. Obviously sleep being key for your mental and emotional and physical well-being. It's not always possible. And I was saying to you at the beginning of this chat that I was up a lot in the night with various toddlers who wanted to, you know, go downstairs and not sleep. But you just power your way through the day and hope for a better sleep
the next night. Exercise is a big thing for you. I mean, would you feel
that is, yeah.
you would get worse if you had a week? Because it's often the first thing that I drop for me when I'm like, I'm too much on, I'm too overwhelmed. Like, I don't need to go to the gym, but then I really notice that I really don't. I feel so much better. I think it's because if it feels like one thing that you, if you get it done, you feel like the psychological impact of having done it is like, oh, that's one thing I'm on top of, or I've controlled, even if the rest of everything else has gone to shit. Obviously, there's endorphins and everything as well. But I know exercise is key for you. Do you get it in every day?
I do try to. I do notice if I don't exercise for a few days, I feel a little bit lethargic and tired, and maybe not myself. And you know, exercise, I think, has become first and foremost a coping mechanism for stress, as you say, the endorphin release, and much less so about any aesthetics or anything like that. It's just really become a way for me to be in my own thoughts or not for half an hour, you know. So I do try to go to Pilates classes maybe once or twice a week. I love just someone else telling me what to do for an hour. You know, we do a lot of kind of playground outings with the kids, park walks, that kind of thing. We're lucky to live next to a park. And then we have a little home gym as well. So I just do try to keep up with kind of home workouts. Again, it's just so I can stick a podcast in my ears and zone out for 30 minutes and just do a little routine. And I just do think it's so important for your mental and emotional well-being, for just feeling balanced, as you say, that element of control when so many other aspects of our days are out of control. So that's, yeah, it's another major one is exercise. And then, you know, I study nutrition, so I am aware of what I put into my body, how I can support my, again, my mental and emotional and physical health through what I eat. I've, you know, introduced ashwagandha at the beginning of this month. I was feeling so burnt out after Christmas and so kind of overwhelmed after the Christmas break. I think, again, it's just busy. You're trying to entertain your children all day. Obviously, school was out for a couple of weeks. And, you know, there's so much to do as well that I just thought I'll introduce it. So I take what I think it's 500 milligrams a day. And I have noticed actually an improvement since taking it. It's an adaptogenic herb. So it does help to buffer stress, lower cortisol. Obviously, I'd say to anyone to check with your doctor if you do start any supplements, because some of them can interact with medications. But I have noticed a difference. You know, I take magnesium and make sure I have my B vitamins. Things like that do help to just support you from a nutritional perspective. So it's just all of these elements coming together. It's a process, because you're growing and learning with your child. And I find that they take the lead. It's not really me teaching them so much as them teaching me. And, you know, children are our greatest teachers, because it's them sort of changing their sleep patterns. And, you know, we go through phases of great sleep, and then Oscar, one of my twins, has been coming into me at 5 every morning, and he just wants a cuddle. And I can't deny him that. I love it as well. But, like, you know, our alarms go off at 6 anyway to get Sophia ready for school. So at 5 o'clock, I find there's no real point in going back to sleep. So I kind of don't. He just gets cuddles in bed. You know, so you're just adapting and learning as you go, and trying to manage your stress and anxiety in the best way possible as well. And that's all we're doing. I feel like we are winging it every day. Nobody knows what the next day holds. It's just about how we can respond in the best way to our situations.
And I mean, I feel like there's always the question of what's next for you. And sometimes it's just enough to be just getting through the day, especially mm-hmm. You have 3 small kids. But do you have your sights set on any new projects? Will there be any more books? Or because you're so passionate about, I guess, raising awareness of fertility issues.
No books in the pipeline. I wrote my third book, When Dreams Come True, in 2021, and released it that year as well. And looking back, I've no idea how I managed with 3 babies in the house, but everybody around me kind of chipped in and helped. And, you know, my mom and aunt used to come and bring them out for walks for a couple of hours so I could get, you know, some work done. And I did start writing the book while I was still pregnant as well. So that helped. But I think when you have a deadline, as you know as well, being a writer and an author, when you have a deadline, you just do it. You just somehow power through and you find the hours. No books planned. It's just a case. I mean, work is always busy. As I said, I can't travel as much as I used to or at all. But I think our one goal for this year as a family is to try and go on a family trip, whether it's a staycation or abroad. I'm not sure yet how it'll work, but we might even, you know, we have nice weather over the summer, go down to Wexford and enjoy the beaches down there, which are beautiful. So really, our sort of, you know, I've simplified life an awful lot. It's about, just as you say, surviving the day, getting through, making sure everyone is just happy and healthy. Life is so busy, just running a household, keeping everyone going, keeping the fridge stocked. You know, it's just busy.
And what about the perfectionism these days? Has it eased off at all?
It's improved. No, it has improved, because there are just things I can't do in the same way anymore. And, you know, there might be a day where I can't get my workout done, or I can't wash my hair or brush my hair. Even, you know, washing your hair, as you know, as a mum, it's a big deal now because it takes so long to wash and dry. I've lowered my expectations of myself, definitely. And, you know, my job, my role at the moment is to look after my children, and I do put them first in everything I do. And certainly until the boys start preschool, they'll be starting at the end of August. And then I might have a bit more time. I'll hopefully have, you know, the mornings a little bit more free, and then I can maybe think of what to do next. But you know, I think you always find a way to fill your time anyway, and whether it's seeing friends again a little bit more or...
But like, to meet yourself where you're at, like, you're in this season of motherhood and it's not always going to be this way. I mean, they will grow up. And I think for me anyway, changing my perception of what success has to look like in a day or a week, for like taking it away from those traditional metrics of, you know, income or professional work, like, you know, just sometimes I spent, a huge portion of my day with my toddler, and I feel like, you know, I don't have anything to show for it at the end of the day, but like, we're alive, we have been fed, maybe the place isn't a total shit show, and like, sometimes that's all it needs to be. And that's like, and I think that's a whole other conversation, but that's really hard for mothers to slow down to that pace of just being day by day when you've been an ambitious person, and you know, you also have the career brain as well. But
I've been the same. I've just had to put everything on the back burner for a few years and redefine, as you say, redefine my idea of who I am and what I want. And what I really wanted was to be a mother, and now it's about embracing it and making sure my children are well-rounded and happy. And you know, nobody tells you. I think when you were talking about giving birth being the final, the end point, what anyone really talks about, I find, is the getting pregnant and giving birth and then having the newborn. Isn't that great? No one really tells you, how do you entertain a one-year-old all day, or what do you do after that? And it's such a big learning experience in itself. And I find once your baby is born, it's all about the baby, as it should be, of course, but
it has to be about you. Yeah, too. You are at the top of the pyramid, and if you fall apart, the rest of it falls apart, you know. Your well-being, I'm so passionate about this. Like, it just, even with questions and the conversations we have, when someone has a baby, how's the baby? And is the baby reaching the birth weight? And oh, has the baby sleeping? It's like, also, how are you? We could have several hours more chats on
topics.
And letting you get back to your beautiful family and your work. Thank you so much for sharing your journey and your experience. It's just so staggering, like, what you've been through, and you're telling me all of this with like such a smile on your face, and you're so resilient, and you're so grateful for where you are, and you're beaming talking about your kids. And
I'm just so happy that I don't have to go to another fertility clinic or take another blood test like that. And just my heart, my whole reason for sharing my story so publicly is so that other people don't have to go through the same trauma, and they will, of course, but if I can just support another couple through what they're going through, that's a job done.
It's about supporting,
giving comfort and hope.
Support and not feeling alone, and not, and like, stepping away from the self-blame. If people listening to this can step away from that, then I think something good will have come from it. But thank you so much for being so willing to share and being vulnerable and letting me have such a great insight into your experience. I really appreciate it, and it's been so lovely to chat.
Thank you, it's been a great chat. I really appreciate it.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
The easiest way to access Owning It Real Time is to head to the link in the episode description or episode details, whatever you call them, show notes. You will find the link in there at the top. You can sign up right away for Owning It Real Time and access the full library of 10 situation-specific audio guides that will help you own your anxiety even more than you've ever done before.